Well, hey, everybody, it's Kevin Stevenson, and you've joined me on I Don't Care with, of course, me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. Thanks, as always. I know you've got other forms of educational entertainment, podcasts, music, whatever that you could spend your time with. But I thank you for spending your time with me over the next half an hour or so. So today's guest is Dave Willis. Dave is a principal in the strategy practice for ECG Management Consultants. And Dave, you know how I like to start my episodes. We talk about everything not healthcare. And so Dave, first of all, welcome to I Don't Care.
Thank you, Kevin. I really appreciate the invitation and the opportunity to spend some time with you talking healthcare and non.
Yeah, well, perfect. Let's talk not first. You know, you and I share a love of baseball history. Unfortunately, you don't root for the greatest team, the Texas Rangers, my team. You're a Red Sox fan. I guess that's okay. So tell me a little bit about, I mean, did you grow up in New England? Is that why you're a Sox fan?
I did. I grew up in New England and come from a long line of Red Sox fans before me. My father goes back to the days of Ted Williams and, you know, I went to my first game at Fenway Park, if I say it correctly, in 1976. So, you know, it's been ingrained in me for half a century at this point. And, you know, for a long time, we all called ourselves long-suffering Red Sox fans.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in the past two decades anyway, it's been quite a joy, although we've not won a title as recently as your team has. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, and you're just like me. I mean, I grew up in a household that loved baseball, and it was my mom. And so whenever the old Washington Senators moved to Arlington back in 72, we were at the old Arlington Stadium on the what we call the Turnpike between Dallas and Fort Worth. And I remember a number of games going out there, and we had a scoreboard. Part of it was in the shape of the state of Texas. I'm sure that's no surprise to you.
Yeah.
With the Texas pride that we have down here. But I'll never forget being out there and looking up on the scoreboard and seeing 116. And so, you know, unfortunately, the Rangers got to migrate to the old Globe Life Field and now to our new Globe Life Park that we finally got smart enough. The ownership for the Rangers finally put a roof on the stadium, and I've been to a number of games there, and I'll be honest with you, I've never seen the roof open.
Well, there you go. Yeah, 116 was never a problem in Boston, that's for sure.
I was going to say, and I will tell you, I've had the distinct pleasure to visit Fenway Park twice. It was a bucket list item for me. I greatly enjoyed both times. And it was kind of funny. The second one, I found a seat out in the outfield. It was a day game against our mutually hated Yankees. And unfortunately, one of the Yankees hit a home run, and I was on about the sixth row, and it bounced. And I'm sure you're familiar with that little concrete area in left center.
Sure.
Bounced off of that, bounces straight up, hits about a five-year-old little boy on the top of his head.
Oh, good.
And it bounced over my head. And of course, you know, all the ballpark people run there and they're taking care of the kid. Kid's crying. He gets great swag. But that night I was sitting in a sports bar and looked up and there I was on TV at Fenway Park. And so I've never been on TV at any Ranger games, but I have to go to Boston to be on TV.
There you go.
And so I loved it, you know, got to get a lobster roll and a Sam Adams and life was good. So I see also that you're working on a book about the greatest teams in baseball history.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about how that project got started and who are you focusing on?
Well, it's a little bit of an avocation for me at this point, Kevin. You know, it's one of those books that I'm sort of perpetually working on, and whether it ever actually gets written is sort of secondary to me, to the process of thinking about it. But you know, there are lots of books that have been written over the years about the greatest players in baseball history. But the question of what is the greatest team, and I think underneath that, it raises a whole lot of questions, which is, what does one mean by team? And in particular, is it what you accomplish in a single season? You know, in sports, we tend to talk about dynasties. So what did you accomplish over a period of time? And how the answer to that question changes depending on your perspective on a number of micro questions underneath that. Mm-hmm. So my ambition for the book is actually to look at all of the existing major league teams in their history and start by answering the question, what was the greatest team in the history of this franchise? Ooh. And then begin to extrapolate up to, okay, what then, you know, might we argue are the 5, 10, whatever greatest yeah. teams of all time? Because, and I don't know if this book has been written, I don't know that anybody has ever looked hard at what's the greatest team in the history of the Rangers franchise or the Rangers Senators franchise going back to 1961. So that is just an interesting question to me and one that I don't think the literature has covered all that thoroughly. So
there Boy, you go. I love that. That's a great idea. Okay, yeah. we've talked enough non-healthcare. Let's get into healthcare. I always like to ask my guests, what brought you to healthcare in the first place?
Yeah. I love answering that question. I hope it's okay, Kevin. I do think, you know, just sitting where we are today in light of the news of recent days, I would like to just take a moment to acknowledge the tragic events at UPMC Memorial in recent days, and just hearts going out to the staff, the patients, the families that were affected, and obviously to the fallen officer, Andrew Duarte, and his family. So,
sure.
You know, unfortunately, these episodes of violence in healthcare are too commonplace, but I never want to miss an opportunity to pause for a moment and say, thinking of all of you.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah.
So, you know, how I got into healthcare, and it's funny how for many of us it turned out to be the case. I don't have clinical training like you do. Mm-hmm. And my
Oh, I don't either.
Oh, well, there you go. So
yeah.
mine
is the DHA, trust me. I'm not a real doctor.
There you go. Right. So my poor assumption. I really ended up there by accident. So I was in my mid-20s going to graduate school. I was studying for my MBA, and I did what a lot of people in their 20s getting a graduate degree do, which is, well, I'm not 100% sure that I know what I want to do afterwards. I think I'll go into consulting for a couple of years and get some broad experience. And I ended up interviewing with a company that, now I'm taking you back to 1996. So this is almost 30 years ago.
Okay.
A company that at the time was not well known would become subsequently quite well known in healthcare, called the Advisory Board.
Sure.
And at the time, they had a number of different divisions, not all of which were focused on healthcare. I actually came down thinking that I was interviewing for one of the non-healthcare parts of the company and ended up getting pulled into an interview for healthcare. And 20 minutes into the conversation, was just talking to the gentleman who would become my hiring manager, and realized that I was absolutely fascinated by mm-hmm. this world. And again, that was almost 30 years ago. And my level of fascination has never ceased.
That's great. Yeah. I know the Advisory Board very, very well from back in those days, because I started in healthcare in 1990. And many of my systems were very active with the Advisory Board. And so I always had a great deal of respect, and always really enjoyed the level of engagement and information that we received there. So very cool. Yeah, we've got some similar backgrounds. You know, I was like you, got my MBA, had no idea what I wanted to do, but it took me 4 years in another industry before I tripped into healthcare, and 36 years later, still love it. So, yep. So you know, the topic that you and I discussed beforehand, you know, that we could talk about today, Dave, I really wanted to talk about, because I know ECG, and I've worked with them on a number of occasions, and what a great organization you have. But you're very similar in the fact that you provide your clients with just tremendous information that's very thought-provoking, and you can help us really kind of put some basic ideas in our markets together with some global ideas in and around healthcare to make them make sense. So I really wanted to talk from your perspective today about, what do you see as those hot topics in healthcare for 2025? Yeah. And just kind of, you know, we can start kind of broadly, but then, you know, if some things really pique my interest, we can delve a little bit deeper into that.
Sure. I'll offer a couple, Kevin, to get us started. So
okay.
One of the things I have been spending a lot of time thinking about over the past 6 months, maybe a little bit longer, is what I'm calling the reemergence of strategy in healthcare. And what mm-hmm. I mean by that is, I know from my experience with many clients, and you know, I've had the privilege of working with healthcare organizations all over the country. You know, if you think about where we were 5 years ago today, we were right taking our first very, very scary days into the pandemic, and just how terrifying all of that was and how uncertain everything was for so long. For many organizations, I think it's only been over the past year that they have finally been able to get themselves back to a stable and operational and financial footing, because for almost 5 years, it was just heads down, do everything we can just to take care of our patients, just keep the lights on. And something happened over those 5 years, which is the landscape has changed. And you know, just the nature of who is your competitor, I think, is a very different question today than it was 5 years ago. So I'm having a lot of conversations with organizations where we're asking questions like, should we have a five-year strategic plan now? Because it's been a while since we've done one. And
And
probably the number one metric of success of that plan is not inpatient market share the way that it has been for 30, 40, or 50 years. It's probably something else, and that something else may vary by market or organization. So just starting to see organizations reflex some of those strategic planning muscles that have been dormant or maybe even atrophied a little bit, just because the exigencies of the industry required that our focus was elsewhere for so long. I think that is a good thing, and I think that is an exciting thing for healthcare to be thinking big again around where the industry is going and where we want our organization to go. So that's probably my number one thing that I'm seeing in 2024.
And Dave, you could not have hit on a more perfect topic for me right now. I'm in the midst of our strategic planning process here, and we are actually, we're doing our, as you said, it's our first three-year plan in probably 5 years. It has been exciting to think, okay, what is healthcare in Central Texas going to look like, you know, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years down the road? Yeah, it's been really challenging trying to really think differently. As you said, we've had so many changes over the last 5 years from a competitive landscape, from a care delivery landscape, you know, from a staffing perspective. And so we've got to figure out, you know, how can we be more efficient, more effective with what unfortunately is a very much limited employee market, particularly around, you know, nursing and other clinical disciplines and physicians. You know, what can we do to continue providing the best care possible in a different way?
I think that's really, really well said, Kevin. And it really nicely encapsulates what I think many organizations are asking themselves again. And I'm cautiously optimistic that we are going to see some good creative thinking around how we solve some of those problems. Because another thing that has changed, not just the nature of who's our competitor, the nature of the workforce has fundamentally changed, as you know, over those 5 years. Some of it is a numbers game, right? We've had people leave the workforce. But a former colleague of mine articulated a phrase called the experience complexity gap, which I think is also instructive, right? So her argument, I'm going to paraphrase, would go something like this. It's not just a question of we have fewer people in the workforce, but the average tenure on many of the clinical rungs of the ladder is lower than it was a couple of years ago. At the same time as, especially in the inpatient realm, the complexity of the patients that we take care of is ever more complicated. So that growing gap between the complexity of the patient care processes, and not just inpatient, this goes through the whole continuum of care.
Sure.
But and the level of experience of the people that we are asking to do that, that gap is widening, not narrowing. So again, we're going to have to think differently around what the solutions are for the populations we serve.
Yeah, you know, I actually had that very same conversation today with one of my nurses, who's a very seasoned nurse, saying that, you know, the younger nurses coming out don't have that experience. They don't want to, and many of them don't even want to take time to gain that experience. They want to come in, maybe work inpatient for, you know, sometimes 6 to 9 months only, and then move on to a clinic setting or a remote work environment, or go on into a master's level program to go to achieve a leadership position, they don't want to pay their dues. And I think there's a lot of frustration with experienced nurses who did pay their dues, who are now seeing a very vastly different generation.
Those generational changes are, and I certainly understand, you know, where there are those who get frustrated by them. And I think that's absolutely fair to a point, but I will inevitably circle those conversations back to, okay, and so what's our answer?
Right. Well, and you know, same thing, you know, I was talking about that and I said, well, then I look to the nurse manager, nurse director. Okay. You hired these people. Number one, let's figure out how can we train them up and how can we retain them for as long as we possibly can. And really instill some sort of a sense of pride, a sense of ownership in your job now to maybe prevent you from taking a very quick next step.
Wonderfully said. Yeah. I think, you know, we can get only so far by talking about what frustrates us about that situation. Yeah. But then at some point you have to turn to, okay, it is what it is. Now, what are we going to do?
Right.
Well said.
Okay. So hot topic number one, there we go.
Yep.
What's next?
So hot topic number two, and I think this is another one where you and I have, you know, each taken a long look at this and I think have some concerns, is rural healthcare in the United States. I mean, I'm not going to tell anybody on this who's listening to this anything they don't know, but the, you know, the obvious challenges are fewer and fewer acute care facilities that are in place, fewer and fewer physicians, fewer and fewer specialty physicians. I get particularly concerned about OBGYN care. I'm very concerned about, you know, we'll always see where these things come out. I don't like to make predictions about what's going to happen in Washington, but we certainly know that Medicaid is potentially on the chopping block. And, you know, what challenges will that add to the plight of rural communities? There's just a lot there that concerns me. I have the privilege right now of working with a hospital that serves a very large rural area. I'm very inspired by some of what they are doing to meet the unique needs of that population. Mm-hmm. But make no mistake, that inspiration is born of ever escalating set of challenges that they face to try to do that. You know, we're past the time where we can just assume that every patient has the ability just to show up and see a doctor when they want to. So figuring out the right way to allocate resources there is really important. I'm sure you must see that in, you know, some of the geographies you serve in Texas.
Yeah, I do. We've got a fairly limited catchment area since we're right smack in the middle of Dallas-Fort Worth and Austin. But we have eight counties with about 500,000 people. And we have nine smaller hospitals, for the most part, critical access that we work with. And we're very intentional about making sure that they remain viable. In whatever form or fashion, if we see a patient for a higher level of care, we're going to make sure that we send them back to those hospitals. But I think a better example for me goes all the way back to 2000, you know, late 1990s into the 2000s. I was in outstate Nebraska. Our catchment area was basically the size of the state of Indiana with only 300,000 people in it. And so, you know, we did have to be very, very intentional about, you know, how do we provide care to these people? Because some of those folks were, you know, 250, 300 miles away.
Right.
And we were their nearest specialist. And so it was fun being on the early stages of telemedicine, but also working diligently to recruit the appropriate specialists into our community so that our market had that capability. Because these are people, you know, a lot of farmers and ranchers out there who honestly didn't want to go to Omaha or Denver, which was the next largest communities for that level of care. But we see, you know, and of course, Texas unfortunately continues to lead the country in closed hospitals. I spent a fair amount of time out in West Texas, and it's frightening, you know, the distance that people have to travel for even basic care.
I think it's probably a situation, Kevin, where there is not a one solution here. So
no.
Regions are so different. The needs of different populations are different. But this is an area where, again, I think we're going to have to see a lot of focused energy and creativity and, you know, begin thinking about things like, you know, what's the support network map for this individual, right? Who else, whether that's an individual or an institution, is going to be helping this person with their day-to-day care. You may be familiar, one story that I like to tell. I know the Methodist Le Bonheur system in Memphis has for years been leaning on their congregational health network to help them do care coordination with the population. You probably are very familiar with the NUCA system up in Alaska, where they've been dealing with the rural Native and Indigenous populations that are so spread out over an unimaginably vast area. And they've had to be creative for decades on ways to do patient engagement and prevention and so forth. And we, you know, even parts of the country that we don't think look like Alaska or maybe don't look like West Texas may have some things to learn from the organizations that are there. So that's another one. The other thing I'm keeping my eye on, probably for obvious reasons, is the general state of public health in the country. Uh-huh. And that's everything from scientific literacy of the population to availability of preventive care to our ability to collect and disseminate data, whether it's on a measles outbreak or H5N1 or whatever it happens to be, but to get the right information in the hands of ideally the population, but certainly mm-hmm. the people who are caring for the population in an efficient way. You know, I think we probably learned some good lessons from the COVID pandemic. I hope we don't have to relearn those lessons in the years ahead, but that's certainly something I'm keeping my eye on.
Well, and the other thing in and around the whole public health debate is I think so many people have lost confidence in our government's handling of healthcare. And I guess my question is, how can we regain that level of confidence? Because, I mean, we've gone from, hey, whatever my doctor says, whatever the government says, yeah, that's the right thing to do, to we're on the other end of the spectrum now, where if somebody mentions, you know, a vaccine or some other intervention, people are automatically, absolutely not, I don't want any part of that. How do we go about rebuilding a level of confidence?
Oh, boy, that's a trillion-dollar question, Kevin. If I had the answer to that, I'd I'd probably have a very different role in the world.
Yeah, I think you would.
But, you know, I do think that you've hit on something, right, which is I don't think there's a short-term fix that says we're going to, you know, suddenly, you know, rebuild massively trust in some of those institutions. That's probably not going to happen in the short term. But I think we do have to start looking at, well, who and what are the trusted institutions? You know, and is it the doctor? Is it my parish? Is it my local community organization that, you know, whether it's a civic organization or a, you know, VFW or whatever it is, what is the organization that I trust? And we're probably going to have to see how do we ask those organizations to play a role here? Because I think if we're waiting for trust to get rebuilt, that's a decades long project, and we probably don't have it.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what very well said. Okay, well, you promised us some positive.
Yeah, I see a lot of really wonderful work, a lot of bright shining lights going on in healthcare. And Kevin, I'm sure as you look across your organization every day, you see incredible people doing incredible mm-hmm. things, right?
But absolutely.
But just to call out a couple, one of my favorite people in all of healthcare is a physician named Dr. Heather Farley. She's currently at MUSC in Charleston. And she's just done, in my opinion, heroic work on bringing into the spotlight the issue of physician and provider well-being, and in particular, mental health and all the stresses that community goes under. I think we are seeing more of a spotlight on that. And I hope we are moving past the days where we just tell, you know, newly minted doctors, well, that's just part of the job. Get over it.
Yeah.
So recognizing that, you know, we do as a society put a tremendous mental toll on the people that we ask to lead our clinical care and making sure mm-hmm. that we are there for them when they need us. So I think there are a lot of programs like that. I don't single out Dr. Farley because I think she is unique. I just think she has been a powerful voice.
Okay. Yeah. She sounds like a good guest for I Don't Care.
we'll see if we can make an introduction, Kevin.
That would be great.
As you can imagine, she has a wonderful personal story that started her on that journey. Who knows where this will be in 5 years, but I am pleased that we are seeing different kinds of market-based mechanisms trying to tackle the the challenge of, say, drug pricing, whether it's Civica Rx or their sister company, Civica Scripts, or Mark Cuban's efforts, or what have you. I'm hopeful that we will continue to see efforts to address that in a way that are not overly heavy-handed and regulatory, because we always know there are unintended consequences when you go that route. So I'm excited to see where that goes. I'm really excited to see, and I think this is one of the things that the newer generation of clinical professionals that you were talking about gets very passionate about, is the issue of care coordination. You know, I had a colleague tell me just a couple of days ago, you know, if you look up the word discharge in the dictionary, you will see a definition that says something like, it's the end of my responsibility. I am discharging my responsibility, right? And her argument was, well, that's exactly the opposite of what we should be doing when we get a patient to the point where they're ready to leave the hospital. That shouldn't be the end of something. That should be the start or the continuation of something. And I like that there are individuals and organizations that are playing such a role at saying, okay, how do we make sure that that transition is not as stark as it sometimes feels, right? And that person feels supported and enabled. I also think, one of my own personal values, Kevin, is gratitude. It's something that I post about on LinkedIn pretty regularly. I see lots of examples, and in particular, I think since the start of the pandemic, of people and leaders taking a moment to step back and just saying, thank you, right? Thank you for the work that you do every single day. Thank you for the tireless efforts. You know, again, I think we all always in the world of healthcare feel that inside, but actually making the effort to step up and say it again and again, I've seen a lot of that. I think that is a really positive sign. So I think there's a lot of wonderful things going on, Kevin. I'm confident we're going to solve more than we won't the problems that are in front of us. I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to share a little bit of my perspective on that.
Dave, it's been a real pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. You brought a lot of things to mind for all of us to think about. If you don't mind, please stay on because I'd like to share a personal story.
Absolutely.
And kind of an encouragement for my audience. This month being obviously February and Heart Month, you may be listening to this later on, but it's February 2025 when we're recording this, and it's Heart Month. And so in my hospital here, we do CT calcium scoring and have done those for many, many years. But this month we decided, hey, we're going to drop that price to $39. And so being the good business development operations guy that I try to be, you know, I'm going to take part in that. So I went in and had my calcium score done the first week of the month. And I've had a couple in the past. They weren't great. I got put on, you know, higher doses of statin and all that. And my, you know, all of my numbers were good. My blood pressure was great. I managed stress for the most part pretty well. But I decided, okay, I'm going to go do another CT calcium score. Well, I did mine. And as one of my very close friends, who was my primary care doc back in DFW until I moved to Waco 5 years ago, said, oh my gosh, that's the highest score I've ever seen. And so talked to my cardiologist here. He said, I really want to go in there and take a look. The next Friday, I went in for a diagnostic cath. And an hour and 15 minutes later, I came out of the cath lab with 4 stents, 2 in the right coronary and 2 in the circumflex. And again, as I said, my numbers were great. I had no symptoms, no shortness of breath per se. But because of that calcium score, and that is just another risk factor that we need to consider in our cardiac health, I probably prevented myself from having a major coronary event. And so I say all that to really encourage my listeners, hey, go out there and take charge of your own health. Take advantage of preventative opportunities. Calcium scoring, while it's not paid for by most insurance companies, it's a really inexpensive way to determine yet another risk factor for your cardiac health. Had I not done that, who knows? I may not have been here today recording this podcast. So thanks, Dave, for sticking around and let me throw in that little personal message out there to the audience. But
Kevin, I'm grateful that you did it, both so that you could be here, and I appreciate you being vulnerable enough to share that message more broadly. So kudos to you.
Well, thanks, Dave. I appreciate that. Again, Dave, it's been great having you. Dave Willis, a principal in the strategic practice, ECG. Dave, hey, anytime, I'd love to have you back on. We can talk more baseball. We can talk travel, but let's talk healthcare too.
It was a great conversation, Kevin. Thank you so much for having me, and have a great rest of your week.
Thanks. You too, Dave.